the kind of this idea of the vampire gentleman is that he is supposed to be alluring because you want to be corrupted by him.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, and obviously for a lot of people in the modern era, the answer is like, why, yes, I would.
Yes, I would like to be.
I'm Paige.
And I'm Megan.
And this is Spooky Science Sisters.
Hello, you are listening to episode 24 of Spooky Science Sisters, a podcast where we present to you a science-based and probably very giggly discussion on all things strange and unusual. And you are listening to the second take of this intro portion because Zencaster screwed us. So sorry if we are less charming for the first 15 minutes.
This week, we are joined by cultural anthropologist Dr. Holly Walters to talk about vampires in modern-day pop culture. Holly, can you take a second to introduce yourself to our audience and then let us know what your favorite pop culture vampire is?
Sure. So my name is Holly Walters. I'm a sociocultural anthropologist at Wellesley College. And my usual caveat to this intro is I actually started as a medieval historian. And that's where I got interested in things like vampires, werewolves, zombies, so on and so forth. And now, however, I work in the anthropology of religion, where I study sacred fossil ammonites in South Asia.
Yay! Yes, and the sacred fossil ammonite stuff is also so cool. What are those called again?
They're called shalagram stones.
Shalagram stones, yes. So you should definitely Google them and definitely look up Holly's work on that. And she's done an interview with the Archaeological Fantasy podcast on them, which was really great. And yes, I am a geologist. And like I said before, I was like, I know I'm not supposed to have one, but I really want one.
Well, remember, it's not the having one that's the problem. It's the breaking one that's the problem.
Well, okay. I had gotten the impression that, like, if you weren't a practitioner of that religion, that you weren't even supposed to have them. But it was also like you weren't supposed to sell them as well, right? So that was, like, part of the problem.
There's a spiritual ban on buying and selling.
Got it.
Oh, okay. So you can have one.
So I can have one. I just have to go and find it. So I guess we're taking a trip to the Himalayas.
Yeah, time to go to Nepal.
Excellent. And we were very excited to find out that Holly got her bachelor's from UW-Madison because that is where I did my PhD and where Paige currently lives, if you, I guess, feel like stalking her. and we really love Madison, so we're always very excited to find another person with a connection to Wisconsin and the Midwest. Holly, where did you grow up originally?
I'm actually originally from rural Minnesota. I grew up in a small town called Hutchinson, which is about 60 miles west of the Twin Cities.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So you are, fellow Midwesterner, which is always, always good.
I am a transplant indeed.
Yeah. Because Wellesley is in
Massachusetts, right?
Yeah. Just outside of Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay. I was going to say, I'm pretty sure it was East Coast, but I don't know. okay. And you have a book chapter coming out on vampires, which is called Vampires as Moral Panics?
Yes.
And that is in Rebecca's upcoming book, which I think by the time this is released will be out. But can you remind us of the title of that and just tell us a little bit about that book chapter?
Yeah. So the book is called Monstrous Males, Fatal Females. It comes out from Lexington Books, I want to say in about a month, maybe. So it should be out actually reasonably shortly. My chapter is called Vampires as Moral Panics. And it started actually a couple of years ago, actually more than a couple of years ago, where I had attended this seminar where the scholar in question was talking about vampires over time. So talking about, this is what vampires were like back in the Greco-Roman world, and here's what medieval vampires were like, and sort of so on and so forth. But continually emphasized how different they were, that they were these really, really different figures and they did these different things. Mm-hmm. But the more I listened, I kept kind of thinking, like, you know, are they though? Like, mm-hmm. really? Like, are they as different as we think they are?
Yeah.
So I ended up sort of going back and thinking about it more. And because I'm an anthropologist, really, I started thinking about it like, okay, what do vampires do for us? Like, what do they mean? Mm-hmm. What kind of meanings do they have? What kind of work do they do? And that was actually the start of this chapter, looking at vampires as kinds of cultural symbols that actually don't change that much over time.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, we got to look at a copy of that chapter. It's really great. So had you, and sorry if you already said this, but had you written other pieces on vampires before this one?
Not specifically, no.
Okay.
I had written things about folklore and about the way in which folkloric figures work and symbols and semiotics, but I hadn't actually tackled vampires up until this chapter.
Okay. Yeah. And we won't forget this time around to ask you what your favorite pop culture vampire is.
Right. which you didn't even know.
I know.
So this question is really, really hard for me, mostly because I've written this chapter and because I do love vampires in general. Right now, I would honestly have to go with the character of Adam from Only Lovers Left Alive.
Which I only found out was a thing last night. So I guess I'm going to have to watch that movie.
Yeah, I've also never seen it, which now I just feel like I've, you know, let Holly down.
Well, that's okay, because apparently we're talking about the trashy ones. So this one's actually a good vampire movie.
Yes. Yeah, this discussion, apparently, yeah, Paige and I know the most about the trashier side of fictional vampires. So.
I know most about the trashier side of most things, just so we're clear.
That's correct.
I don't have the world's... best taste in television. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Admittedly, Paige and her friend Sarah have sucked me into a weekly Bachelor watch party on Hulu where we watch an episode of The Bachelor and basically just like talk shit in the chat the whole time.
Well, as long as you don't make me watch Twilight again, I'm not going to
tell. Oh, we didn't tell you that that was part of agreeing to do this. Would you have to sit through the entire Twilight movie?
Oh, no.
Yeah, the recording portion is only like 45 minutes to an hour, but then we expect you to stick around to watch the movie with us.
The rest of it is all Twilight.
I don't think you want to know what my next article is going to be like if you do that.
Why Twilight is the worst.
Dedicated to Megan and Paige.
Okay, but before we talk about Twilight, and this is really bad, we have like guests on and like, yeah, like poor Rebecca, we made her talk about zombie poop, so that was unfortunate for her. And Sarah and Karen had to talk about cannibalism a lot, and like now poor Holly's on here and like, let's talk a lot about Twilight.
She'd probably rather talk about cannibalism.
I was gonna say, can I just talk about the zombie poop instead?
It's not all Twilight. I promise you guys. I promise. Okay. But Paige, did anything spooky happen to you since we recorded last?
So no, nothing spooky happened. But, and I don't know if you want to take this over, you can, Megan. But we, in the original recording, talked about the famous fight that my husband and I have gotten into about Twilight.
Yes, our family has some family vampire folklore.
Yeah, I figure we could use this as a quick chance to recap that story. So yes. If you want to take it, Megan, go for it.
I do. So this was, even though it's your fight, but this was Paige's high school graduation party. My husband and I had driven into town for this. And I think it was like the evening after the party, we're all hanging out and the last Twilight movie had just come out. And so we were all going to go see it in the theaters because I hadn't had a chance to yet. And Paige's now husband, Elliot, like just downright refused to go. Like, he would not be a good sport about it. He just would not go. And it like made them get into this massive fight that like we all still remember and talk about. And it was just, now in hindsight, like the funniest thing, but like was probably the biggest fight between the two of them that like any of us have ever witnessed. So yeah, I would say like I'll ask you what you think our comparable one was, but like my guess was like Steven and I, our comparable one would be the Mad Gab incident.
Absolutely, right? Mad Gab.
Yeah.
No, hands down.
Holly, the Mad Gab incident is, we're, my husband and I are no longer allowed to play that game against each other anymore.
No.
Because each of us was getting annoyed with the other one for feeling like they were like breaking the rules and coaching their partner too much. And yeah, it ended up with me calling him an asshole and like leaving the room in front of everybody. So you know.
Well, at least it wasn't over Twilight.
You heard it here first. The vampire expert says that Paige's fight was worse.
Well, what I was going to add to that is you can go ahead and tell him that I wouldn't have gone either.
Yeah.
And I actually work on this stuff.
Oh man.
Oh jeez. Okay, so Holly, you can tell us again about your something spooky.
Well, I mean, obviously not a whole lot spooky happens because we're all in a pandemic and we don't go anywhere and we don't do anything.
Right.
So it's pretty limited. I think the closest thing we probably have here is, so my husband and I live in a very old house. It's about 105, 110 years old. And of course, like old houses, it makes noise and falls apart and things break and all of that sort of fun stuff, mm-hmm. which is just affectionately referred to as the house ghost. So house ghost, you know, occasionally knocks shutters off and things fall off the walls or the stairs just don't work anymore.
I'm sorry, the stairs don't work?
Sometimes they creak and sometimes they don't. And other times the attic makes noise. And
I was trying to figure out, like, how do stairs stop working?
But other than that, that's about as spooky as it gets around here. Just have to sort of pay attention that anytime you say house ghost, like, something will happen. So
okay. So now we've made you say it, like, a bunch of times. So potentially it's going to be an exciting weekend.
Right, so waiting for, like, plaster to fall in or the rug to start on fire.
We must have, like, a plumbing ghost that follows us around because both houses that I've owned now have had remarkably bad plumbing issues, which is not great.
It's probably the same plumbing ghost that followed you guys to our wedding and Kelly's bachelor party. So it's you. You
and
guys are the problem.
Your original – I mean, your parents' house in Sylvania, like, had pretty bad plumbing as well.
Yeah, we have a plumbing ghost.
We're cursed.
Well, in that case, I think technically it's a plumbing poltergeist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, officially, Greg the ghost is a poltergeist. Gregory. Anyway, that's a story for another time. All right. Well, we can talk about vampires, and kudos to us. We've made it to the same point where we realized that we were not actually recording in 16 minutes instead of 18 minutes. So
there we go.
See? Good for us. All righty. Well, if you haven't listened to our first episode on vampires, which was episode 11, you should go check that one out. In that episode, we talked more about possible scientific explanations for vampire stories, which were essentially people misunderstanding natural decomposition of bodies and various illnesses. But we didn't really say too much about the folklore, so that's really what we want to focus more on this episode.
Yes. And Holly, you covered, I guess, sort of a couple different, or at least briefly covered a couple different origins of vampire stories in your book chapter. But one of the original ones you said was the succubus and incubus myths from ancient Greece, right?
Right. So one of the things that I at least tried as much as I could in this chapter was to point out that the Greco-Roman understanding of the vampire, particularly the incubus and the succubus, were quite different than what happens to the vampire in the Euro-American world much later. Mm-hmm. But this really is kind of the first recognizable moment we have of the night-dwelling, blood-drinking spirit that, you know, roams around, drains the essence of the living, and continues on.
Yeah. And I guess, do we have any concept of like where those stories might have come from? Like, is there any like real life situation that those, or is it just like today where it's like they saw it as more fiction, or like did they actually believe that there was like succubus and succubi, incubi? I have no idea what the plural is.
No, that's right.
Yeah. Okay. Succubi and incubi, like roaming around and drinking people's blood.
That's a hard call to make. I mean, we can't really say what did they really believe was happening, because mm-hmm. we can't ask them, obviously.
Yeah.
we generally have a sense, I would say, that it was probably a combination of things. They may have gotten stories from elsewhere that had similar aspects to them. We mm-hmm. definitely know that there were vampiric figures as far as ancient China. Wow. And other areas of Asia Minor. So it wasn't as though they necessarily lived in a vacuum at the time, mm-hmm. but it could also have been related to their own sense of fear of evil, fear of the night, fear of disease, probably. Mm-hmm. I think there are some scholars who make arguments that they're related to issues of sleep paralysis and the experience of sleep paralysis.
Okay.
Could also have been good old-fashioned hallucination.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. I think the first time we did a vampire episode, we, like Paige said, focused more on like medical explanations for like why people might, you know, think they were vampires, and the fact that, you know, there was a time where people were like staking corpses and stuff to make sure that they weren't rising back up, and that they were digging up bodies and being like, oh, they had blood around their mouth, so like clearly they're rising up and drinking people's blood, you know, after they've died. And it's like, no, that's just what what corpses do. So other than that, like there hasn't been too much time where people like actually thought that there were vampires. Like they've always sort of just been folklore characters. So I don't know.
I think the interesting part of the Greek and Roman versions is they're not human. So yeah. the Greek and Roman vampire is really not a vampire that's about the risen dead. That's something not going to come into vogue until the Middle Ages.
Okay.
So I think there really is a shift here symbolically, that the Greek and Roman vampire is, I think, more about a kind of spiritual night terror. It's not yet a fear of the dead or plague or the risen dead. And, it, yeah. and they're not related to decomposition. They were never alive in this
case. Okay. Maybe more terrifying.
I tend to put it as these are monstrous vampires. Like, these are really monsters.
Okay.
They're not human. They're not related to humanity. They're something else at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. Ooh. Scary.
And I'm sorry, when did you say that at what point does that shift?
We're not really going to start seeing the vampire of the risen dead until Europe. So that's going to come in at about probably the 700s or 800s at this point.
Okay. And isn't some of that like related to the rise of Christianity or something? Like, I forget what the... Why? Sorry, we're gonna.
There are vampire myths before then.
Okay.
And that's part of the argument, again, that I make mm-hmm. is that the vampire of the old world, sort of the pagan vampire, is very much a monstrous figure. It's it's not a corpse, it's not human.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be until we start seeing shifts in Eastern and Western Europe in and about. Coming into the Dark Ages, where we start seeing it's now the buried dead, which are endangering. And those have to do with purity laws. So the vampire in this case is an impure figure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, and I would assume some of that too, like, kicks up with, you know, fear of plague and stuff like that at some point, because like you could catch it from dead bodies and stuff. So
not until the 1300s though.
Okay.
That's kind of, again, like the early vampire is a really interesting figure because it looks so different than what the modern vampire looks like now, which is really a product of the Victorian age.
Mm-hmm.
But these older vampires, and this is what I argue in the chapter, is that these older pre-Christian vampires are really representative of the things that societies fear about themselves. That's why I call it vampire's moral panic.
Yeah. Okay.
Gotcha.
So in these cases, people who could become vampires were someone who died a virgin, someone who died at birth, someone who died deformed or with a caul over their face, someone who died as a criminal or a murderer. So it was really something that was focused on a kind of taint of evil.
Yeah. Although, like, dying a virgin doesn't really seem like makes you tainted.
There's some seriously gendered issues going on with a lot of vampires, which is true today, just as much as it was true back then. Mostly what they looked at it as, an unmarried girl who died a virgin would come back because she had been robbed of her rightful place in society.
Oh, dear. Fucking men. Like, get out of here.
I think I even recount one of the early Irish versions of the story, which was, if a girl did die unmarried, she would be married post-mortem. So she would be married to a young man in the village who would therefore be considered a widower, so that she would not return as the vampire.
Wow.
Oh, no. Yikes. Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah, if you ever wanted to have a lovely corpse wedding.
Yeah, imagine being the poor. I mean, yeah, it's obviously... Imagine being the poor guy who has to marry the dead.
Imagine being that poor guy's next wife. Like, oh my.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's it's sad for everybody in this situation. But like, here's your dead wife.
It's not. Wow. It's not great. That's sad, though. I mean, that's sad for everybody. Like,
yeah.
Oh.
But you can really see, I think, how certain fears about evil and taint and corruption were at play even as far back as these early versions of vampire story.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, that's like ancient vampires. And today we're going to focus more on pop culture vampires, possibly to Holly's dismay. But
no,
we can... We can skip forward a little bit and skip forward to Dracula, who, as far as I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was sort of the birth of like the modern vampire, or like of, you know, what we think of the vamp as the vampire today. Like, everybody knows who Dracula is. And I did want to bring up the tidbit that you had in your chapter that, like, possibly Stoker was influenced by stories of about Vlad the Impaler, who apparently, like, drank the blood of his executed enemies. So, yikes. but in his creation of Dracula, and that, like, Dracul is, like, means dragon in Romanian, and his family crest was like Order of the Dragon, so it's possibly where the name comes from. So yeah, but you said that that's, you know, potentially not correct.
So yeah, it's, I mean, the thing to kind of try and parse out is there's Dracula the literary and media character, and then there's Vlad the Third, who's mm-hmm. the Romanian warlord that Stoker may or may not have been referencing. Most of what I focus on in the chapter is Dracula as the kind of progenitor of the modern literary media vampire. Mm-hmm. That he becomes the iconic figure by which all the vampires after him are compared to, more or less.
Right.
Whether or not Bram Stoker based his character of Dracula on the real 15th century Romanian warlord, Vlad III, is debatable, mm-hmm. And it kind of depends on what historian you ask, but it's clear that he knew the name, mm-hmm. that he had some exposure to the history of the region, as he was clearly drawing from it, mm-hmm. and the character that he builds is somewhat loosely based on Vlad Dracula. There's also his father, Vlad Dracul, so there are actually two different people by that name, but Dracul and Dracula, meaning son of the dragon, and the Order of the Dragon, which was his family crest.
Oh, okay.
And he did, in fact, impale people as a form of basically psychological warfare.
Yeah.
Hence the sort of blood drinking and impaling that Vlad III was involved in. Wasn't so much vampiric so much as it was about his war with the Ottoman Turks.
Yes. Yeah. And like, yeah, medieval torture is like a whole other thing, but.
But it certainly did give Bram Stoker a lot to work with when he was creating the character of Dracula.
Yeah.
And so what's most likely is that Stoker was blending sort of some of the superficial historical facts he knew about Vlad III with Icelandic and Teutonic folklore about vampires.
Okay, got it. And then that, I guess in popular culture, Let the Right One In is Swedish?
Yes,
okay. So there's got to be some, like, potentially there's some connection to, like, folklore in that story as well. Okay. Iceland, it makes sense to, like, have, you know, a bunch of stories about creatures roaming around in the night, because there were, like, long periods of the year where it would just be dark all the time. So, yeah. Right? Iceland's far enough north for that? Yes.
Yeah. Okay. If you watch a lot of, like, international vampire movies, uh-huh. you will see aspects of their particular folklores in those stories, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, amazing. Okay, but so Dracula, though, comes out in 1897?
Yes.
Okay, which is considered Victorian. Here's the thing, I don't know anything about time period.
It is. It's sort of okay. Late Victorian in its particular time period.
Okay, but that's like their jam, right? Like, they're all into like seances and like ghost stories and sort of like, yeah, gothic horror kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty solidly a gothic horror kind of genre.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, can you refresh our memory or as to like why that type of fiction, I guess, gets popular at that time?
Again, I think that's debatable. There's a lot of Victorian fiction that's like that.
Yeah.
And what I think at least a number of literary theorists have argued is that for the Victorians, that kind of shockingness of violence and sexuality, mm-hmm. which had been otherwise so far repressed, was something mm-hmm. that they could access in the written word because it wasn't an image.
Okay.
So images were deemed, you know, obviously too salacious. You can't expose people to images of blood and death and nudity if you're a Victorian. But you can write about it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But they were super into death and creepy stuff. And yeah.
I mean, if you read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Frankenstein is sort of the same way.
Yeah, it totally is. And we found out before that she had written that after the eruption of Krakatoa, I think. So it was a really dark, stormy, time period. So it's perfect for sitting around and writing a creepy book, a creepy monster story.
But it's also, it really also is kind of the advent of the human vampire.
Okay.
Not that vampires weren't human before then, they were corpses before then, but
yeah.
Part of the mega, mega shift that Bram Stoker's Dracula does is we're actually meant at this point to see the vampire as a person.
Yeah.
That we're supposed to identify with him and think about his motives and his experiences in a way that the vampires before him did not do.
Yeah, and he has would we say that Dracula is sort of, and full confession, I have not read Dracula, and I don't.
Oh, no.
I know, okay? And I don't think that I've seen, any of the Dracula movies. Have you, Paige?
I don't think I have either.
So, I don't know.
We are failing you.
I don't know shit all about
it. Falling down on the job here.
What you're learning is that we don't know shit about vampires.
Also, to be fair, when I was writing this edited chapter, one of the ways that I went about doing it, the way that I wrote the second half of it, is I decided to do a full filmography.
Ooh.
So I took 20 vampire movies from every decade and spent mm-hmm. 6 weeks straight watching them.
Holy
20
moly.
From every decade?
I did. So I started with Nosferatu in the 30s.
Yeah.
And went 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2010s, and did 20 vampire movies per decade.
Wow. Some of those you must have been really dredging out the...
Oh, some of them were just trash. It was just terrible.
Yeah, because it was, yeah. Okay.
That's insane.
Yeah.
I've watched Twilight.
So my fair warning is I have seen a lot of vampire movies.
A lot of vampire movies. Holy shit. Okay. But would we say that Drac, because he has a lady friend, right, in the book / in the story? Would we say that he's the first time that vampires are sexy?
He's not the very first time, but he's sort of the classic example of it. In particular, that he kills a young woman by the name of Lucy Westenra, who is this very sort of sweet, innocent, virginal kind of girl whom mm-hmm. he turns into a very sexualized woman after she dies.
Oh,
again, getting into precisely what the Victorian world feared most about mm-hmm. women at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Where for the Victorians, he represented the dangerous foreigner coming into Britain and corrupting women, which is what he does in the book.
Oh, gotcha. Good Lord.
And after she is killed, then the story essentially revolves around the relationship of Jonathan and Mina Harker, who are sort of our two central protagonist figures, as Dracula is hunting Mina Harker.
Oh, okay.
And of course, she is saved by her would-be husband, Jonathan Harker, mm-hmm. and Abraham Van Helsing, our now iconic vampire hunter.
Okay. Well, there you go. Paige, we should probably watch some Dracula.
There's a Aquila for you in a nutshell.
We have a lot of reading and movie watching to do.
I know, I should have done it for this. But oh well, here we are. So next step along our little vampire tour here is before we go into, I guess, sort of the nuances of different pop culture vampires, which, yeah, like, are just ones that Paige and I particularly like. The trashier ones. We just wanted to put out there, like, we want to put out there, like, what would be the definition for a vampire? So, Paige, do you want to dive into that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think even when we talked about it on our first episode, our main definition was that they drain, you know, to be a vampire, they have to have these fangs and they have to drain the vital essence, which is typically blood, from animals. I mean, that was like, that's kind of where our definition, I think, stopped really on our first episode. But there's also these other, you know, vampire characteristics. So they, you know, cheat death. They're immortal. Some of the things are that they have this superhuman strength and healing power, that sun has some sort of effect on them. But, you know, these are all just characteristics. I don't know if there's like a specific definition that you typically would go by, Holly, or that you would, you know, say that every vampire should have these things.
From the literary point of view, or even from the folkloric point of view, generally it's even somewhat simpler than that. It's the vampire is a figure who cheats death by surviving by draining the essence of the living.
Okay. Like,
that's pretty classically the vampire. There are certainly vampires that are not affected by sunlight. Even folklorically, they're not affected by silver or crosses until the advent of the Christian era. So usually we tend to focus on that the vampire is a figure who is cheating death, living an immortal life by draining life from the living.
And that, I mean, that makes sense because that's true for like every vampire story I've read, where some of the other stuff is not. Did you have something, Megan? Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, and like at some point it switched to like, oh, they used to be human, but not so much early on.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I would say the modern definition is they were once human. That's mm-hmm. certainly been the case since, obviously, the Dark Ages. The vampire before then wasn't, but, you know, most I think popular culture vampires would fit into the was once human or to some degree still is human.
Mm-hmm.
So then I guess I don't know. I guess like the superhuman strength and speed thing sort of makes sense, right? They're viewed as monsters. They have to have something. So the speed and the strength makes sense. But I've always found it kind of bizarre that like vampires are seen as monsters and, you know, they're known for sucking your blood, yet like they've got this healing power, because like what do they really need it for? Right, like they're immortal, but nothing's gonna kill them, and they're going out and they're gonna like suck my blood, I would think, to kill me. Like what's the benefit? Like why did this healing power thing ever come into play?
Honestly, I think part of that has to do with vampires are being differentiated from zombies.
Okay.
Zombies break apart and rot and fall apart and lose fingers uh-huh. and toes and arms and so on and so forth. The vampire, on the other hand, is supposed to represent a kind of stasis. Like the vampire is unchanging.
Yes.
So
okay.
The healing probably has more to do with this idea that they always return to their principal form. They're always the same.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that makes sense. So then they're not changing, they're not dying, essentially because they have this power.
More or less.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if they did eventually break and fall apart, then they're really not anything different than a zombie.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, and some vampires are squishier than others, you know?
Yes.
That's
true. Yeah.
Like the True Blood ones are like, they can get messed up. But then like Twilight, they talk about them being more like stone, essentially.
Right.
So I don't think you would like cut them. I don't know.
The other like pretty common thing with vampires that like I don't, which like maybe this is a silly question. This might be a really obvious one. I'm just not, I don't know. But I've been wondering about is this whole like they have to be invited in. And that seems like pretty common for like other supernatural beings. And I don't know that I understand.
Yeah, do you have any idea
why.
Of the origin of that?
Yeah, actually, that is something that happens in Eastern Europe. In the Eastern European folkloric setup for vampires.
Okay.
In a lot of pre-Christian Europe, the hearth and the home is a sacred space. So crossing the threshold of a home or crossing the threshold onto a hearth is a protected space, particularly among, that's why a lot of magic at this time is called hearth magic or hearth women. As a term for women who practice magic.
Okay.
So in these cases, vampires as corrupt, unclean spirits cannot pass this threshold without an invitation because they are magically disinclined to do so.
Huh.
Okay.
I feel like that gets, okay, and correct me if I'm wrong, but am I wrong in saying that that sort of gets like flipped around on people though? Like, if it's like hearth magic and that kind of stuff, like, is that where like the witch's cauldron and everything comes from?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it does. I mean, one of the comments that I make in my chapter is that stories of vampires and stories of witches, as far back as the early part of the Dark Ages, are deeply entwined. They in fact overlap.
Yeah. I just feel like the Christians were just like, okay, well, vampires are like, you know, the devil, but like also like the witches were like, or the people were like protecting themselves or whatever, like behind their door, like with their hearth being a sacred space. But like then Christians were also just like, well, fuck you guys too. Like you can't be a witch either. So
well, and that once the vampire became associated with devilry in the post-Christian era, so too do witches become associated with devilry. That now they become these two figures that are essentially allied with one another, whereas prior to the movement of Christianity into these areas, the witch was almost certainly an adversary to the vampire.
Yeah, and I mean, you still get some of that in pop culture, because like in I guess vampire-containing universes that like have both witches and vampires, like they're frequently pitted against each other. Like True Blood, for sure, it's like that, right, Paige?
Yeah,
True Blood's like that, and Discovery of Witches.
Discovery of Witches is
like that as well.
I guess True Blood maybe a little less. Like I guess maybe they're naturally pitted against each other, but they seem to like work together a little bit more than some other stories.
It's unclear.
Yeah, but definitely Discovery of Witches. They're like enemies.
Okay. And then we talked about how they're unchanging. So Twilight really fucked that up because like there are other ones though. Like is Twilight the only one where it's like you basically just like get hotter when you become a vampire?
Actually, no. I wish, but no. I actually suspect that particular variation coming out of Twilight comes from Interview with the Vampire, Anne Rice's work.
Okay. Yeah.
Anne Rice did not necessarily set up her vampires as getting hotter after they died, but she does have this description that their transformation makes them perfect. Like, they still look like themselves, but they're unblemished.
Okay.
So I'm assuming, and obviously I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming that Twilight took it from there. Considering that Interview with the Vampire, I mean, the book comes out in 1975, and then the movie was, what, 91, 92?
Something like that, yeah. And I'm, like, pretty sure that Stephanie Meyer has, like, said that she was a fan. It's unclear, though. I don't know.
So, yeah, my guess is that she probably took that particular aspect from Interview with the Vampire.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but like, I mean, it's all sort of related to like even the like Dracula and stuff. Like, it's supposed to be some like they're supposed to be alluring or whatever, or like I don't know, pulling women over to the dark side.
That's definitely an aspect that comes in Bram Stoker's Dracula that never leaves.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of this idea of the vampire gentleman is that he is supposed to be alluring because you want to be corrupted by him.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, and obviously for a lot of people in the modern era, the answer is like, why, yes, I would.
I would like to be.
In the Victorian era, that was a warning. Like, it was supposed to be he lures in these innocent girls to their death via sexuality.
Yeah.
And to the Victorians, this is terrifying. Whereas, obviously, to most of us in 2021, it's like, you know what? It's better than what I got going. So
it's fine. I'm fine if a mysterious immortal vampire comes and like sweeps me away. It's okay. sorry, Paige.
And that's definitely an aspect I think I noted that happens in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like once I swapped over from. There's a really stark division in 70s vampire films between 80s vampire films and 70s vampire films. Like, this is Hammer horror kind of a thing. Like, these are blood and monster and, you know, Christopher Lee and so on and so forth. And then we sort of hit the 80s and everyone's like, you know what? I'm kind of down with that, actually. This is okay with me.
Yeah, mostly okay, but like it's such, some of it's just bullshit though, like because it's like the, you know, they talk about the, and I it, like obviously like yes, the Victorians are using this as like a warning of like here's what happens if you're impure or whatever, but it's like, I mean, they were still people, they had the same like urges and desires and of modern people, but
yeah, anyway. Of course they did.
But it would still be like remarkably funny to like make a Victorian person sit down and like watch True Blood or something.
They would probably find it incredibly shocking.
Yeah. I mean,
not to say that they wouldn't like it, but they would find it shocking.
That's my point, is like you like it a little bit. Like, don't lie. Anyway. Okay, Paige, do you have anything else that you wanted to chit-chat about before we force Holly to talk about Twilight?
No, I think it's probably good that we start jumping into some of these. And we have like, so we have like all of the characteristics of the vampires.
Oh, no.
Okay. But we probably won't hit every single one of them.
No. Yeah.
Lucky for you.
I was like, I don't want this to be like poor Holly, like, oh, we're going to put you on a quiz show. Tell us where that comes from.
I'll try.
It's fine. Okay. But we chose three of our favorite pop culture vampires to really focus on? Would we say that are their favorites?
Okay, Paige? So I would probably say that yes, they're three of our favorite, but as you have all heard, we've not really seen or read a whole lot of vampire stories at this point. So like probably, really it's like the three that we know the most about.
Yeah, we have not seen some of the more literary highbrow, we don't know. We're down here with the commoners. To be fair, I have seen both versions of Let the Right One In, so I feel like I get a little bit of credit for that, and I will not apologize for loving What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, that is an amazing series and movie.
Yes,
I love it.
I haven't seen him.
Yeah, Paige hasn't seen him, so Paige is
in trouble. Okay, you have to start with What We Do in the Shadows. It's probably my favorite one going.
Well, my husband loves it, so I don't really know why he hasn't made me watch it yet, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
but
it's like, it's absolutely dumb that he just hasn't made you watch it, because you're going to think it's so funny. Like, I tell Steve, so I've seen the movie several times, I've watched the show, and I've like told my husband, like, it's like one of those movies that like if someone was like, what is your sense of humor, I'd be like, just go watch this movie, that's it.
That's, and if you get the chance, see the series as well.
Yes, yeah,
the series
I've watched the first season of it. We have the second season like saved on Hulu. I just haven't watched it yet.
I've heard not great things about the series.
That's absolutely wrong.
That is hilarious. Wrong. Whoever is wrong. Objectively wrong.
Holly's the expert.
Someone who has seen like 400 vampire movies spanning a century.
Yeah, I'll take your word for it.
Is that the official number? So it's 20 per decade, which is what? Yeah, what's the total number of vampire movies that you've seen
just for this chapter, or that I have seen?
Maybe just for this chapter. I mean, unless you think you can add them all up.
Yeah,
just for this chapter, I think my filmography was, let's see here, 280 something.
So just a couple. Well, you've seen a couple of them.
Although they said like frequently will come out with those like, oh, Netflix wants you to sit in a dark room and watch Netflix for 48 hours straight. Like, and they'll pay you $1,000. Like, will you do it? It's like, yeah,
yes,
okay.
And then I'm
going to
write it back.
Correct. So we have picked out three, but we, both Paige and I, went through a period when we were super into Twilight. Paige was like in high school / early college, so it's less embarrassing for her because I was like fully in grad school.
And I was forced to watch it while writing this chapter.
Anyway. And then we also want to talk about Discovery of Witches, which, are you familiar with that, Holly?
I am not, unfortunately.
Okay. That's like, it's good. Okay.
It's mature Twilight, though.
Basically.
Like, let's just be real about what it
okay.
is.
Okay. Like, are you familiar with Outlander?
Oh, vaguely.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind.
I know what it's about, but I haven't watched any more than the first episode.
I was going to say that Discovery of Witches is like if Outlander and Twilight had a baby, but like more mature than Twilight. Anyway, I think it's worth it.
I don't know if I can stand
but
the flashbacks, honestly.
Oh, yeah. Would you say, like, are you still watching new vampire stuff now, or are you just like, no, I'm never doing vampire stuff ever again?
Oh no, I actually still keep up with it. So I'm actually watching The Strain right now.
Oh, I only saw a part of the first season of that, and then didn't keep going, but is it worth it?
I'm only two episodes in, so I don't know. But I actually do still kind of routinely watch vampire movies when they do come out. I'm really selective about my vampire media, however. Okay. Like, I won't watch anything because I don't know if I can take it. But if it's really good, I absolutely will still watch it.
Okay. I feel a lot of... It's too much pressure. It's too much pressure for me to tell you to watch Discovery of Witches. It's like it's a show now. Like, they've made the books into a show, and like, it actually is quite good. But if you didn't get into Outlander, then like, I feel skeptical. Anyway, that's number two.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Great. And the third thing, the third vampire, pop culture vampires that we pulled were the True Blood ones, because we watched a lot of True Blood. Paige has finished it. I never made it all the way through.
Yeah, don't. Don't watch any further than you've watched. It goes off the rails. So yeah. Gets so weird.
Okay.
Don't do it.
Yeah. But Holly, have you watched True Blood?
So my experience with True Blood was kind of the same thing. I had a friend of mine who made me watch the first season.
Okay.
And it was fine. And then I was like, oh, so maybe I should probably keep going. She was like, no. No, you stop now. It stops now. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. What season does it really go off the rails, Paige?
I think it's good through season three. And then I think at that point, you might as well just stop.
Yeah.
But there's like six seasons or something, isn't there?
Yes. There's like six or seven. It went pretty far.
Yeah, it goes too far. Way too far.
So anyway. I know enough about it, like, up through season one.
Yeah.
Okay. I
mean, that's, yeah.
That's really that's all you need
to get you.
And every response I got was like, okay, you stop now. So.
Yeah. That was, okay. Okay. We'll talk about it when we talk about it. We're going to start with Twilight. We're super excited.
We're going to get your favorite one out of the way.
Yeah. Like, full disclosure. I've read all the books. I own but have not read yet the, like, new one that just came out.
Yeah, I still have to buy it.
I, like, still regularly watch the movies for fun. They're kind of one of those, like, guilty pleasure. Like, I don't have to think about this. I just watch it. It's fine. But Twilight is, like, a good starting point, though, to talk about, and you kind of touched on this before, just, like, so much of vampire fiction is just sort of, like, men being sort of shitty, but they're, like, romantic about it, so. So we're like, this is great. Yeah, but, like, so, like, Twilight definitely suffers from that, like, yeah, if it, like, weren't, you know, vampires exist, blah blah blah, we'd be like, all the men in Bella's life are, like, sort of abusive, or, like,
not great.
Yeah, like, not great. She doesn't have a lot of agency, which, yeah, like, I'm sure comes from just, like, how vampires have been, that it's, like, I don't know, impressionable young women who are, like, getting sucked in or whatever. So I don't know if you have any additional thoughts on that.
I mean, I don't know how far you want me to dig into it, but there's also the aspects of Twilight you can't really separate from their Mormon theology.
Yes. Yes.
A lot of the way that the Twilight vampires are framed, which I still actually think fits more or less with my argument, is that they're about the things that young women are not supposed to do.
Yeah.
But yeah. Edward is also framed as this hyper authoritative character, as yeah. most of the men in Bella's life are, not shockingly. And
yeah.
kind of borderline abusive in in sort of many of the things that they do.
Yeah.
But the arc of the story is very much linked up with this idea of she redeems him through marriage, or is supposed to redeem him through marriage, which doesn't really go quite so well in the grand scheme of things. But the vampires here really do still represent this idea of fighting against this kind of internalized corruption, the sure. sort of monster within theme.
Well, yeah, and that's, like, the whole, I mean, that's a big theme in the book, which, like, gets a little exhausting. He's like, oh, I don't think that I have a soul or whatever. I don't know. It's whatever. I'm so fucking rude. but yeah, but it is, like, interesting that, I mean, you can, like, you can tell that Stephanie Meyer is Mormon, because it's, like, a lot of other pop culture vampires are, like, it's all about, like, sex and, like, all the stuff that you shouldn't be doing. And it's, like, Twilight is, like, oh, they're supposed to be very, or he, like, Edward is, you know, very pure and, like, is a virgin and, like, doesn't want to do all these things or whatever. But it, like, makes the same point, though.
Like, just it does. It's going for the same problem.
It's different, but it's not. okay. Does any of the stuff, like, okay, they're, like, physical characteristics. Do any of those go back to, like, older stories? Like, stuff like, oh, you have to rip off their head and burn them to kill them, or they are cold-blooded?
Yeah, and before you answer that, sorry, Holly, I actually have a question just about death in general for vampires, because every story has, like, something a little different. Like, this is the ripping off of the head and burning. I think for True Blood, it was, and I know staking. We'll get there, but True Blood staking, which is, I think, the thing that I always thought was most common vampire stories.
I mean, there's, my answer is going to be a bit layered in this one. Because actually these things don't all come from the same time. Mm-hmm. The staking through the heart is something that comes out of the Middle Ages, which was related to pinning them to the bottom of their coffin.
Oh, okay.
So you would actually hammer a stake through their chest to nail them to the bottom of their coffins so they couldn't sit up.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other most common ways was to behead them and to destroy the head.
Okay.
So a lot of it had to do with where you thought the seat of life was. So was the seat sort of where was the seat of the soul? If the seat of the soul was in the brain, you had to destroy their head. If it was in the heart, you had to, you know, stake them through the chest. Burning was something that really came up during the plague. So dragging the body out and burning it finally was this association with cleansing by fire, which was something pretty big in medieval Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you can see the parallels with the witch stories and the witch panics. But also it had the effect of destroying a plague-infested body.
Mm-hmm.
And so the modern vampire kind of picked up a conglomeration of these.
Mm-hmm.
And it became, you can stake them through the heart, you can behead them, you can set them on fire.
Okay. So it's basically just like, here's how... here's the various ways in which people like tried to deal with... people/corpses that they thought might be vampires in the past.
So the idea behind it is generally earlier vampires only had one method by which you could destroy them. So it was mm-hmm. not all of them at once.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the later literary vampire that kind of picks up this plethora of methods.
Yeah, depends on which vampire universe you're in. What you have to do.
Like, there are some that focus more on staking to the heart, and then there are mm-hmm. some that focus more on burning. But mostly, these are all a variety of medieval methods for dealing with corpses suspected to be vampiric.
Got it.
The other thing I think, I don't know, it bugs me a little bit about the Twilight series, and because I've not, you know, read a bunch of vampire stories, it may be in other ones too, I just don't know it. But in, I think, a lot of stories, and these other two that we were going to talk about, to, I guess, like, be a maker, to create a new vampire, you have to drain a person of their blood and then basically replace it with your own, which I guess then would make it seem like the vampire's blood is kind of what gives you the power. But then in Twilight, it's like they're like snakes or like spiders. I don't...
Oh, I love this question. I'm so happy somebody asked this kind of question.
Good.
Because, like, this is... I'm trying to think of, like, a vaguely diplomatic way of framing all of this.
We're not diplomatic.
We're just not. The very early forms of the vampire is sort of interesting in this respect, because in, like, the Greco-Roman world, vampires could not make their own. So you turned into a vampire because of something was wrong with you. Like, okay. You were corrupted, you were tainted, you were therefore the one who was in danger of becoming vampiric.
Mm-hmm.
It's not until much later in the Middle Ages when we get this concept of the vampiric bite. So the early version of this is very plague-like. So it's coming out of that era of the Middle Ages,
yeah,
where you could be turned into a vampire by being bitten by one.
Okay.
So there was a lot of fear about, you know, if the vampire sneaks into your house at night and bites you and turns you into a vampire. And this was doubly terrifying because it now meant that you could be innocent and be corrupted.
Okay.
So the vampire's bite now spread like plague.
Yeah.
And it's not until after the Black Death that we start seeing it now takes an exchange of blood between the undead and their victim, which now takes on this idea of you can intentionally become corrupted.
Oh.
So you can sort of see the shift happen of the vampire's bite harms the truly innocent, like... The person who does not want to be turned is forcibly turned against their will because they're attacked.
Yeah.
And then this shifts into this idea of the exchange of blood, where now you have become corrupted because you fell to the sexual wiles of the vampire. You were seduced into it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And that's like a pretty common trope too. Like, even in, you know, in Twilight and True Blood, maybe a little bit in Discovery of Witches, like, but you have characters who, like, you know, have been made into a vampire some, like, I don't know, more or less against their will, but it's like, yeah, they're like big issues with like not having agency, like in that decision and everything. So yeah.
I mean, and because the metaphor of the vampiric kiss and so on and so forth is so heavily sexualized by the Victorian era and afterwards, there really does become a synonymous metaphor going on between vampiric turning and rape.
Yeah, like the idea of consent and all that stuff. Yeah, goodness gracious. I only laugh because it's like, oh, that's terrible.
Fake smile hiding real tears.
Yes, right. But it's like, I mean, yeah, it's just fascinating how people take, like, here are the things that we're afraid of, here are the things that we're worried about. Yeah, I mean, things like some sort of like being sexually violated or like, you know, death or disease or whatever, and like turn it into this like mythological character that represents all these things. But like, I again feel like the vampire is particularly interesting because it's like, it's a funny one to talk about on this podcast a little bit, because like I feel like a lot of times we have like, here's an actual real life explanation, or like, here's an actual real life animal or something that exists that like could be this creature or like could cause this phenomena. And it's like, vampires are just like, I don't know, here's all the fucked up shit that we do to each other, like, or that we're worried about we're gonna do to each other. And like,
I mean, that's part of the argument that I make is, you know, are there real world analogs to some of these things? Yeah, right. Sure, there are.
Okay.
And they certainly probably influenced a variety of different forms that the vampire goes on to take.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also a cultural anthropologist. So what I tend to focus more on is that's only part of the story, that the vampire really goes on to embody so much more than just, is this an actual thing that people think is actually stalking them?
Right.
Because part of the answer is no, not really. But yes, they do think the vampire is real.
Okay.
I know it's a little ambiguous.
Yeah.
But I think a good kind of another example of that is when I got to the vampire filmography of the 90s, that is a moment where for the vampire as a figure, the vampire also becomes queer.
Yeah.
Which is mid-gay panic, mid-AIDS crisis.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the vampire quite literally comes to embody AIDS.
Well, and especially the involvement of, like blood and stuff. And you're talking about, like,
and the idea of a male vampire inflicting this sexual kiss on a member of the same sex and infecting them.
Mm-hmm.
So my point to what Megan was getting at is that even sort of this queerified vampire of the 90s is speaking to something quite real that's going on in the world. Yes. But, you know, do people actually think that gay men are vampires in the 90s? No, not literally.
Yeah. I mean, somebody out there does.
Oh, I'm sure some people do somewhere.
Somewhere that's a thing. Okay, so the other thing, we are going to move off Twilight so soon. But a couple other things. So Bella gets... which maybe you didn't make it this far into your Twilight experience, Holly, but Bella gets pregnant at some point, which, like,
yes,
that
yes, I made it that far.
That scientifically doesn't make any sense, but but like, isn't that the like the incubus myth thing?
Not really.
No, I thought they like impregnated people. What am I thinking of?
they generally don't. Okay. That's a feature of vampires of Asia.
Oh.
Which one of my thoughts behind that is not generally a feature of vampires until you start talking about anime.
Okay.
Okay.
So there's a possibility that Stephanie Meyer in this case could have been influenced by anime.
Okay.
I don't know what her media diet looks like.
So but, what you're saying is we have strong evidence that Stephanie Meyer watches anime, which is fine, but, you know,
I would say
unexpected.
It's strong evidence, but but the concept of vampires being able to impregnate people or to have children is something that is much more common among the Asian conceptualization of vampires than the Euro-American world. Because usually in the Euro-American concept, the vampire is dead. Like,
yes.
They cannot produce children because they are dead.
Yeah.
Whereas Asian vampires are cursed.
Yeah.
Versus being dead.
Yeah. Also, side note, because I forgot to say it. Well, sort of side note, where I like definitely thought you were going when we started talking about like, how do you make a vampire? And like, how do you, that some of it's like, oh, you just get bitten and then it morphs into now you have to have some sort of like exchange. I like 100% thought you were going to be like, yeah, they're just substituting blood for sperm.
In a respect, they are.
Yeah.
that is basically how it works.
Like, it because, like, yeah, I mean, obviously, whatever. I don't know what I'm gonna say. I'm not gonna say anything intelligent, so I'm just not gonna say anything at all. But that's definitely where I thought you were gonna go with that. Okay, so there's also in the Twilight world this like connection with like Native American folklore, for better or for worse, which I'm
for
sure
worse.
Is problematic, yeah, in some way. Are there, or do you know, like, are there any like Native American legends like that would be akin to like what we would think of as a vampire?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. Or at least not that were adopted from elsewhere.
Okay, got it. And then, okay, and then the other thing about Twilight, and like that is also a thing in True Blood, is that they like pit vampires against like wolves in Twilight, but like,
oh yeah, know, vampire can, versus werewolf is a yeah, favorite like, of the horror genre.
Yeah, is that just like a you know, just like a thing, or like does that come from anything? Like why?
Well, in the Middle Ages, they're not associated with one another, generally speaking. Werewolves have a very different background and valence than vampires do.
Yeah.
It probably is something that's more like a product of the horror genre in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the horror genre very much likes to pit monsters against one another. I mean, there's like Dracula versus Frankenstein and all this sort of stuff. Where we get this idea of vampires and werewolves as being kind of like natural enemies probably has more to do with the evolution of the werewolf as a more sympathetic figure.
Okay.
So originally the werewolf was, again, a kind of warning figure about losing one's humanity to an animalistic nature.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what the werewolf is.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually when we start talking about people who are like, you know what? Getting closer to nature by turning into a giant wolf sounds pretty decent to me. And start to actually identify with that kind of figure rather than as a figure of danger.
Uh-huh.
Pitting them against the vampire sort of just makes horror sense at that rate.
Okay. Although, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's like the way in which you, like, you become a werewolf, like, because you get bit and, like, I don't know. It's just, it's similar, but it's the same, but it's different.
Same idea.
Okay, Paige, should we move forward? I don't know. We've kind of been all over the place pop culture wise, and that's fine. We're just
we've already covered quite a bit, I think, from each section. The one comment I want to about Twilight, because it's always cracked me up. And you may not like this, Holly, but it's always cracked me up because people make, I mean, and I do too. We all make fun of the story. But like specifically we make fun of Edward and like make fun of like the sparkling skin and all the stuff. And it's like literally of all, at least of all the vampire stories I've read, which we've learned today is not very many. he is like one of the more powerful vampires and like is pretty much impossible to kill and is like super strong and fast. And it just cracks me up that everyone makes fun of him. And yet he is like I don't know. He just seems like one of the most powerful ones. So it feels like somebody out there should be sticking up for Edward. So I don't know. That's all I have to say about it.
I think the usual criticism I've run across in that is all of what you just said is true, and the best he could do was go back to high school.
Yeah, I've seen that too. It's like, seriously, you guys, you have like a lifetime to, like, I don't know, do something great, and you're like I'm just gonna go to high school.
Do whatever you want, and what you decide to do is go to high school AP bio.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, well, and here's the thing, like high school girls are like fucking insufferable. So like, come on, man. Anyway, I'm sorry to any high schoolers listening to this podcast, but I was a brat when I was in high school. So, okay. So we've covered some of the stuff about Discovery of Witches, but a couple things that I wanted to make sure that we touched on, I guess, and like get thoughts on, I guess. So it's funny that we were just talking about sort of like pitting werewolves versus vampires, because in Discovery of Witches, I don't think there are werewolves in this like little magical creature universe. I don't think so. But they talk about like for vampires, like almost as like their family structure is like a wolf pack like family structure. And like they choose like a lifelong mate and stuff like that. So I don't know. It's just like a weird take on it that is.
Yeah, that is a more like werewolfy take.
Right.
Mostly in most classic vampire stories, the vampire is solitary.
Yeah, no, this is like they're like a family unit with like a pack like structure. So yeah. So they're doing it different. One thing that I wanted to ask for sure was, okay, so Twilight Carlisle is is a doctor, and a Discovery of Witches, the main vampire character, is a doctor. Is there like anything that, like, have any of the previous ones been, in your vast knowledge of vampire fiction and movies, is that like a thing for a reason, like other than like easy access to blood?
Thing, now that I think about it, like there's a number of vampire movies in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s where the vampire is actually a doctor. But in those cases, they tend to play it as this codes him as a good person. Like, he's a doctor. He wants to help people. Therefore, he's not the villain.
Yeah.
He's good.
Yeah.
And it also simultaneously gives him access to blood without killing people.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what I would say, like, for Carlisle and Twilight. And, like, to some extent, to Matthew in Discovery of Witches.
But, for example, like, Only Lovers Left Alive plays on this trope a little bit.
Okay.
Adam, who's the protagonist, who is the vampire, isn't a doctor, but he pays a doctor to give him blood bags.
Okay. Okay.
And it's, again, especially for the purpose of not killing actual people.
Got it. Do any of the, I guess, folklore or, like, okay, so vampires are always like, oh, it's very top secret and like nobody can know about us. And, you know, some of them, it's like they're hiding in plain sight or whatever. So Discovery of Witches, vampires eat food. Like, is that like, yeah, like some are like, everybody knows you're a vampire. It's very obvious. But like
they do in Twilight, too. They don't do it for new, like, they don't do it, like, they don't get any nutritional value from it. But, like, I have read that, which I don't remember this, supposedly, like, the Twilight vampires would eat, or they eat and then, like, hack it back up.
Gross.
So that way it looks like they, like fit in. Yeah, but that way it looks like they're, yeah, like, fitting in. And same thing, okay, with Discovery of Witches.
Yeah, it's usually done as a kind of trope of they pretend to eat. Like, they don't actually get anything out of it, but they can, you know, choke it down if they have to.
So I have a question about that, though. Like, if they're, and this is, I mean, not that I expect necessarily anyone to have an answer for it, just something that's always annoyed me is, like, if they're not gaining anything from the food that they're eating, then, like, why are they able to get drunk? Because, like, all the vampires can drink alcohol and get drunk, and I've never understood it.
They address this in Discovery of Witches. They say,
have I gotten that far?
No, but it's not going to spoil anything. And I think okay. they talked about it earlier. that he can, like, drink wine and, like, enjoy it, I guess, for the flavor or whatever. But he can only get drunk or, like, be exposed to the effect of medicines if it's in the blood of somebody's blood that he drinks.
Yeah, that's something that was also done pretty heavily in, I don't know how familiar you are with Vampire the Masquerade, the role-playing game.
No.
So, yes, one of the big pop culture movements for vampires happens in the early 90s with the advent of the World of Darkness role-playing campaign and the publication of Vampire the Masquerade, which is a vampire-specific role-playing game. And that sort of that game setting dealt with it the same way, is if the person the vampire was feeding on was intoxicated or under the influence of medication, the vampire would be two. But that would be the only way that was possible. Actually, ingesting it themselves did nothing.
Okay. Well, I feel a little better then. I either haven't read that or I just forgot about it, but it makes me feel better because it's been driving me crazy. I don't know why.
Scientifically,
it's like I've not been able
to
let it go. Yeah, it makes more sense. It's all fine now.
It's all fine. Well, I feel like that's all everything I was dying to address about Discovery of Witches. Do you want to move on, Paige?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do True Blood.
Okay. okay. So True Blood, which Holly has only seen one season. I've seen four. Maybe? I don't know. Paige has seen the whole thing. She was committed. True Blood's more like, I don't know. Like, to me, they're more like, they're like vampire vampires. Like, they're not the sparkly vampires. They're more just like, they're a little scarier, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, sort of.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I would say they're more vampires than Twilight vampires are vampires.
I mean, there's more like horror to it for sure. Like, there's a lot of blood and all that, which is,
and there's way more sex and like they I would agree with you.
Yes. Yeah, this was like True Blood was like the first of the like high budget like cable TV shows, like, you know, HBO or whatever channel it was on, that I really watched. So it's like it's a little bit of a special place in my heart, despite being very campy.
I would agree with that. It was like the first real, I mean, I don't know if I'd say it's a really really good show, but like watching it was like the first like really good show that I had watched.
Holly's like, you guys are terrible.
To be fair, I'm pretty sure True Blood came out when I was still in high school. So
this is like way more acceptable for you. I maybe have terrible taste. Okay. But I mean, first and foremost, like, it's like pretty obvious that True Blood represents like the acceptance of the LGBTQ plus community, right?
Well, I mean, it's definitely representative of the kinds of queer representation that particularly like HBO and paid streaming services were more willing to engage in.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, this is not the first time the vampire has ever been queer coded.
Yeah.
That's something that has really hung on in the vampire mythos really heavily since the 90s.
Yeah, I guess I was just saying it in terms of like a lot of the, because there's a lot in that show about like religious people being against them and like, you know, thinking that they're evil and associated with the devil and stuff. But like a lot of the language that they use is like very similar to what you hear as like being discriminatory towards the queer community.
Sure.
Yeah. And like, I think they call it like, oh, they came out of the coffin or whatever, rather than, you know, coming out.
So they're being reasonably overt with it.
So they're like being pretty overt about it. So I guess my point is like that show comes around a time when like, I mean, it's like early 2010s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like to me, I guess like it comes at a time where I felt like a lot of that stuff, like just got a lot more open and like we're all
I mean, this is obviously roughly around the same time that, you know, the United States is dealing with the marriage equality debate, and we're seeing more trans visibility. So yeah. It's actually not surprising, kind of once again, that the vampire is going to take on that fear,
mm-hmm.
much as the same way they had before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, well, yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, it's a silly, campy show with like a bunch of ridiculous soap opera stuff in it, but it's just, but it's just interesting that like, yeah, like you said, that like throughout all this history for like the past, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000, whatever,
years. 2,000 like, years at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like had this like pretty important role in like what is happening in society. So good job, vampires.
I mean, and that's part of why I ended up writing the chapter that I did.
Yeah.
Was, yes, you can look back at sort of the history of all these vampires, and yes, they're all sort of very different,
mm-hmm.
but they're different in the same way.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what my argument was about, is that what's changing is their context and not really the vampire themselves.
Yeah, right. Vampires are awesome. And clearly, like, there's so much vampire fiction that I really need to catch up on.
Yes, apparently you do.
I'm sorry. I felt so good. I was like, I feel like I've seen a good number of vampire things. Like, this is great. And it's like, no, I've just seen, like, the garbage vampires. except for What We Do in the Shadows. And Let the Right One In is legitimately very good.
Hey, if you ever want to take 6 weeks of your life and absolutely waste it on 280 vampire films,
you have
I've
a list.
Got a list.
Good to know. Yeah,
that could be like an entire podcast in itself. Like, we watch every vampire movie on Holly's list. Okay, Holly, do you feel like there's anything vampire pop culture related that you are dying to discuss that we have not talked about yet?
Not specifically. I think maybe one of the last things I'd mention that I really particularly find fascinating about the modern vampire mythos, mm-hmm. is really it's something that tends to be associated with teenagers.
Okay, yeah.
Like, most of the time when people think about vampires, like, they think about, like, the goth teenager and so and so forth.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think I pointed out at one of the last talks I did is that, in fact, the vast majority of vampire fans or fans of, like, vampire film are not teenagers. that
yeah,
they really are a genre that I think gets associated with kind of the disaffected youth.
Sure.
But they're really associated with disaffected middle age.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, that was like a whole thing, though. It was like, yeah, like middle-aged women like getting super obsessed with Twilight and stuff. And it's like, oh, they're like teenagers, but it's fine. Like, even I was like borderline too old for it.
But I think it speaks to something about vampires. Really, I mean, yeah, we can sort of say like, oh, vampires are for kids. I would actually say they're not. Like, they're more about terror of corruption, terror of mortality, terror of failure. Like, these are not the kinds of things like young teenagers really worry about so much. But really,
or at least hopefully they're not.
Or hopefully they don't.
Yeah.
But they are the kinds of things that older people think teenagers worry about.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. So really, in a kind of big way, vampires are really like the terror of the older generation.
Yeah. Oh. This just means that I'm old.
Hey, listen. I watched 280 vampire movies today.
You're dying. That's done something to your life expectancy.
I'm certain it has at this point. Just looking at being like, that's just like 10 years of my life gone right there.
Yeah. Okay, so you said your favorite was, sorry, remind me of the name again.
So my favorite vampire character?
Yes.
Right now, if I'm going highbrow, I would have to say it's the character of Adam from Only Lovers Left Alive.
If I'm going highbrow.
If I'm going lowbrow, it's Nandor the Relentless.
Yeah.
From What We Do in the Shadows.
Well, I have to watch it.
Yeah. Of all of the ones that you watched, do you remember, like, what was the worst one?
Oh, man. Like, just atrociously bad?
Yes.
There were so many.
Yeah.
And they blend together. one of my absolute campy favorites. And it's because it's just awful, mm-hmm. but it's so much fun to watch. it's a vampire movie. I want to say it's from the early 80s.
Okay.
And it's called To Die For.
Okay.
And the reason I fell in love with it is, so I think it came out like 1982, 1983, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clearly this mid-budget vampire movie that they cast with a bunch of soap opera stars.
Oh, no.
From the early 80s. Like, I don't recognize any of them. I just know that they're all a bunch of soap opera stars.
Yeah.
And so it's this vampire movie, which is supposed to be this, like, highbrow 80s vampire movie, but they're all from soap operas, and they're acting like it's a soap opera. And it's just blindingly painful.
Yeah.
Is there a specific decade that seemed to have, like, significantly better vampire films or significantly worse ones?
I can't charge any decade with being better or worse.
All right.
they all have their, like, highbrow and lowbrow versions mm-hmm. Of these movies. Mm-hmm. I think I have to hand it to the 80s, however. That the 80s came up with such a spectrum of terrible vampire movies, but they're terrible in completely different ways.
Uh-huh.
One of my other favorite ones I'll make a plug for is another 80s or fantastically 80s vampire movie called The Vampire Journals. It was filmed in Romania. So, like, they were trying in that respect.
Yeah.
But it's filmed with a bunch of British actors in Romania, and all of the props are so god-awful bad that it's distracting. Like, one of the characters has this sword, like this gigantic longsword, but it's so clearly plastic that it's hard to get through the scene.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, you just handed this, like, mid-level Shakespearean actor a Minecraft prop, because that's what it looks like.
Oh,
so,
no.
Ultimately, I'd have to say I'm going to hand it to the 80s that the 1980s came up with the best lineup of really tragic vampire movies.
Good to know. Good to know.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the one last thought I had where we were like, yeah, because there's so many that we didn't talk about, right? Like, there's, like, friggin' Sesame Street has a vampire. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, I talk about it in my chapter. I'm like, there's the Count. Like,
yeah, Count Von Count. Yeah, Sesame Street has a vampire. There's, like, Buffy. We talked briefly about Interview with a Vampire. There's Blade. There's... I don't know. There's a thousand. Like, there are so many vampire stories.
There's so much. I think just about any person out there, also, you can kind of tell how old the person is by what vampires they remember.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm sure, like, yeah, people who are, I don't know, a decade older than us, Paige, would be, like, more like Interview with the Vampire people, or, like, maybe Lost Boys. So, yeah, but there's also Lost Boys. So there's, like, Vampire Diaries is a whole show. Like, holy shit, there's so many.
Now you know why my filmography got as high as it did.
Yeah, well, and you were just doing movies. You didn't do shows, because there's, like, however many seasons of Vampire Diaries.
I had a few shows in there.
Okay.
I just didn't cite them the same way, because necessarily watch all of it. Like, I've seen most of Buffy.
Yeah.
That was in there. There were a couple of other series that I watched, like From Dusk Till Dawn, and
mm-hmm.
like the movie and the series, which was equally terrible. But they're in there.
There's just so many, and, like, it's interesting that you're watching, like, The Strain now, because, like, those are, like, they're kind of bizarre vampires. They're, like, I don't know.
Well, it's a good sort of note to end on that mm-hmm. the vampire is transforming again.
Okay.
Like, we're seeing more and more the terrifying monstrosity of the vampire.
Okay.
Where, again, the vampire is contagion.
Yeah.
Not shocking, given that we're in a pandemic.
Yeah, right.
But we're also seeing the return of the inhuman vampire. We're seeing the vampire that no longer even looks human.
Right. Yeah, because that's those is like they almost went the way of like, to me, it's like they almost went the way of more like being more zombie-like because they're like, they're pretty messed up.
And they're also sort of linking it to some degree with things like the Cthulhu mythos. So we're seeing the sort of tentacly gross, slimy kind of creature.
Yeah. Yeah. I also, when I was looking up stuff, I'm sorry, I keep thinking of other things.
No problem.
Speaking of that, like one that was like that, but that came out, you know, like a decade ago, if not more, was I Am Legend. I don't think I realized that those were supposed to be vampires and not zombies.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Did you
a little bit
that
of a
page?
Post-apocalyptic take on it?
Yeah. Yeah. I knew that.
Oh, okay. I thought I had it in my head that like those ones were zombies or considered zombies, not that they were vampires.
Yeah. First time I watched it, I had the same thought, and then I rewatched it, and I don't remember who it was with, and they had talked about them being vampires.
They don't come out in the sun, so that would be like that would be the kicker. Okay, well, this has been fun. We were maybe a little all over the place, and we had to re-record the first 20 minutes. So sorry, Holly.
That's okay.
One of these days we'll get it together when we have a guest on.
Maybe once we're 2 years in.
You're right. But thank you so much for joining us and for entertaining us while we ask you all our ridiculous, silly questions about vampires and where the various stories about them come from, because you have a much more intelligent take on it than we ever would. So we really appreciate
it. Now you get to go home and do the reading.
That's right. Do you have anything before we do our little sign off that you wanted to, I guess, re-plug or re-talk about or let people know where they can find you if that's something you want to do or whatever?
Well, I certainly can. You can always come and visit me on my blog, which is peregrinationblog.com. My caveat is that I don't talk about vampires there. I, in fact, talk about sacred fossil ammonites of the Himalayas, which is what my ethnographic work is about. Or you can also come and say hi to me on Twitter at Manigarb.
Excellent. Yeah, and we'll link to both of those.
All righty. Well, I think that's about it then. Thanks again, like Megan said, for joining us and for sticking with us with some technical difficulties we had there in the beginning.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, spooky people, that wraps up this week's episode. Tune in next time for our discussion on Wendigos. If you like our show, please hit subscribe and share it with a friend. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpookySciPod, Facebook at Spooky Science Sisters, and at our website, SpookyScienceSisters.com. If you have any questions about previous topics or ideas for future episodes, email us at SpookyScienceSisters@gmail.com. As always, thanks for listening and stay spooky.
I can't stop, must follow. Stream October Pod wherever I go.
Was you thinking about the show?
Oh, please, please don't start on me now, Rollo, please.
Rollo says smile! Rollo says dance! Rollo says
go summon the devil! Edward October presents October Pod, a terrifying spook show. Available now on YouTube and at OctoberPodVHS.com. OctoberPod, retro horror for bold individualists.
This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.